This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Carl Orlantes about his latest novel, Cold Victory. And I will say, Carl, it's really nice to see you again.
Yes.
We for the people who are listening, in my new studio, I get to see the people who I am talking to, which is really wonderful. But this will be the fourth conversation we've had about your books, which makes you the most prolific guest that I've had. So it must mean that I like your books, which I think is the case.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it.
So, okay, this book is really different from your last books, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, with some similarities because you are the writer still, but yeah. You set this book in, I guess I would say it's an amazingly interesting period that most of us probably have not thought about, period and place.
So yes.
1947 in Finland, and maybe you could talk a little bit about how you got there.
Why I chose that and all. Yeah, there's two main reasons. One is in 2014, when Russia invaded Crimea, I immediately thought about the winter war with Finland in 39-40, because it was much the same. They just overwhelming force took over 10% of the country. And so I thought, well, there's some amazing parallels there. And I happened to have an uncle who, because he was fluent in Finnish, he was a career army officer, became the military attaché to Finland in the mid-50s. And so I had some stories from him, one of which turned into that ski race in the novel. And I can tell you the real story if you're interested. But the combination of the war with Russia against Finland, and Finland was just like Ukraine, but had no help from anybody. And so they lost. If you talk to a Finn, they only tell you about winning the winter war, but unfortunately, the history is different. They lost, I think, 11% of their land and had to pay reparations to Russia or Soviet Union, who invaded them and couldn't accept martial aid. I mean, they were severely restricted for decades. And that's what some people want to see happen to Ukraine, you know, sort of, well, we'll just make them neutral. They don't become neutral. They are under the thumb of these days, Russia. So the two things, got me thinking about it. And, another thing was I've spent a lot of time overseas, how incredibly naive Americans are. I mean, and Louise, one of the female protagonists, she's sort of the archetypal American. She's smart. She's go get 'em. She's got a big heart. She's, you know, trying to do the right thing, but she's totally ignorant about Finland and about Russia. And just, some people have criticized me saying, no, she's just not real. No one could be that naive. And my answer to them is that, you're so naive about how Americans are that she seems too naive to you, you know, because I've been around a lot and we're really pretty bad. I had an incident where it came home to me in a very hard way. I was in Kashmir with my family and staying with some friends who happened to be Sikhs, and some leader of the Muslim community, which is 94% or something like that of Kashmir. They really, most of them wanted to go with Pakistan, but the ruling power in Kashmir in 49 went with India. So there's always been a turmoil and trouble there. He came back from the Hajj and a riot started. And I mean, a full blown cars going up in smoke, firebombs. And, So he and I put our families under a big oak table in the center of the house where we, when the rocks were coming through the windows, at least they would be safe under the table. Then we went out on the porch and all we had was some big sticks, like cudgels. And I'm watching this riot going on, this pandemonium. And I turn to my friend and I say, my God, I said, where are the police? And he looks at me like I had come from Mars? And he says, Carl, the police are Muslims. Oh, that was the first time it hit me. Oh, rule of law. We take that so much for granted that, you know, people complain about the police, you know, Black Lives Matter and stuff. And yes, they've made some mistakes, but basically they're on the side of the law, not on somebody's on your side or the other guy's side. And that was an incident where I began to see how we have, as Americans, are just never exposed to what life is like without privacy, without, you know, rule of law, without our constitution. And most Americans just, you know, don't think about it.
General, taking a lot of that for granted.
Yeah.
You know, as we have done, but also being provincial about the rest of the world, because, you know, the way America operates, we're the center of the universe.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I wish they could do a New Yorker cartoon. You know that famous one where they show the Hudson River and then there's sort of like the West Coast, nothing else. And Americans, all of America, I think, has that problem. We just need to sort of get our education system more internationally oriented, but we're protected by two oceans. And that's another thing we take for granted. People are sort of like, oh, why are we worried about what's happening in Ukraine? Well, by God, the Poles are worried about what's happening in Ukraine and the Latvians because it's next door. But we have that luxury of like, well, you know, so Putin takes over Ukraine. Well, then the rest of NATO goes down. Well, you know these people. I, of course, you can tell by the tone of voice, totally disagree with them. I think we've got to fight Russia now, not us personally, because we're lucky. I mean, but to give Ukraine what they need, and I mean what they need to go deep into Russia. But anyway, we're going to talk about books, not.
But I think it's interesting because I did make the connection as I was reading the book that it was a similar situation to 1947, where you place it and you can give the immediate history of what happened in Russia and Finland. And I've thought about that era quite a bit because, you know, my familial roots are Lithuania. And
there you are.
You know, they're in the same general region and had the same, not necessarily the same story as the Finns by any means, but that same being a small country with Germany on one side and Russia on the other side, making it impossible for them.
Yeah.
In the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in America, we don't, and it is true, even at that period of our history, I would venture to say we were even more isolated in 1940, let's say 1941, and barely understood what was happening in the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah.
And World War II, which, I mean, I think it's important in a way because culturally, your book places your characters in this new world, 1947, when things were really different. And Americans and Russians were beginning to feel differently about each other.
Right.
Which is really the heart of the book is the different outlooks of, I think, the characters from the American side to the Russian side. And you have that, as you talked about, this sort of naivete of Louise, but even the naivete of her husband. He's heroic, but
yeah,
and he kind of well-meaning, even though mm-hmm. he understands he's there as a military attaché. He can't trust anybody. He knows that he's under scrutiny at all times, but he's still, you know, he and this, the Russian who is his friend from the war, they kind of have this romantic relationship as if the real world didn't exist. And I mean romantic in the sort of, not that they love each other romantically, but they have this romanticized view of who they are as soldiers and as human beings that is tragic. And that's the real, you know, that's the tragic story.
Yes. Yeah, that's the flaw, the tragic flaw. Is naivete and thinking or wishing the world was different than it is, which we're all guilty of it to some extent. I was just reminded when I was a child, I was probably about seven, when Stalin died. And I remember it because it was all over the Astorian Budget, our local newspaper for Clatsop County, and this giant 4-inch headline, Uncle Joe dies. Uncle Joe. That, right. I mean, you know, this was a very union heavy, you know, left wing sort of county, but, you know, because of loggers, but they thought of him as Uncle Joe. I mean, he was one of the most horrible tyrants ever to live on the earth. Uncle Joe dies. And I just, I at the time, I didn't think much of it. Who's Uncle Joe? And my dad said, well, he runs this something place called Russia. And that was it for a 7-year-old. But when I look back on it, again, how naive we were. I mean, we saw him as this avuncular sort of, you know, guy with a mustache that was helping us out.
Right. Well, what that was sort of the propaganda side of World War II.
Yeah.
That lasted into, you know, maybe 1948 or 49 when the Cold War, well, the hot war of the, you know, the, you had the Korean War beginning.
That's right.
Yeah. Real change in the way, in the outlook of America toward Russia. But it took, you know, it took a few years. And, you know, we had just fought. I mean, I think about this periodically that, you know, you and I are similar, from a similar era. And that when we were growing up, all of that history was fairly fresh. Most of our parents were involved in the war in one way or another. And, you know, and it was still active and alive in their consciousness of daily life, even though when they came home from the war, everyone wanted to put it behind them and live their lives because they were lucky to be alive.
Yes, and they felt it. On the other hand, they joined, you know, the American Legion and they VFW, and there was a lot of sort of, you know, trying to retain that feeling. I think, again, like I can always remember my parents saying, well, that was during the war years. But when they talked about during the war years, it was not like, oh, that was the terrible war years. It was during that's when we were all pulling together war years. It's a very different sort of sense. There was big tension in our little town because my dad went off to fight. He landed in Normandy and was in the Battle of the Bulge. So he had this whole European war experience. But a whole lot of the other guys were loggers, and that was a protected industry. They made shitloads of money while the other guys were off being privates and corporals in the army, making nothing and risking their lives. So believe me, there was some tension about the warriors for at least 2 decades. Until finally everybody's testosterone levels went to zero. And that's
But, you know, growing up, we heard about that war.
Yeah.
And in the same way that probably kids of the next generation would hear about the war in Vietnam as a live event. You know, it's, you know, each generation has its own history. But today, a reader who's probably under 40 or 50 would not have the same resonance. I'm thinking about reading your book, reading this book. It's a period that would be fairly unknown to them. And maybe, you know, your...
Even people of our generation, most people go like, wow, I never knew that happened. You know, sure. I never knew Finland fought on the side of Germany. I mean, you know, things like that. Well, against American naivete.
Yeah, but it's also, to be fair, what we learned, it mostly was the big story. And that, you know, you learn about England and you learn about Germany and you learn about Russia and the United States and all the smaller countries that were drawn into it in one way or another. I would venture to guess if you wrote a book about that took place in Denmark or Sweden, you had the same
well,
you know, well, you know.
Absolutely.
And all those, and it really, I mean, you think about the numbers of people in World War II. That were killed or displaced or
I think it was like 100 million or something. Yeah. I mean, an unbelievably large number. Yeah. It still remains the greatest catastrophe we've ever invented.
And I kind of thought, you know, I think you wrote about that in this book as background in a really evocative way. You know, when the two Americans show up in Finland, the war is pretty fresh for the people there. Who suffered, and So, you know, they're having also to reconcile or reckon with, it was an active war zone. It's a place where people were fighting. And as you sort of said, in America, yes, we went through the war, but like for Louise, she was at home. She right. never experienced being bombed or having, tanks roll through the country as Finland did. Although they fought also kind of amazingly, that whole ski troop, fighting, which was just amazing. So there's a lot going on in this book that I think is kind of exotic. I don't want to say exotic. Well, I do want to say exotic in a sense that we don't have it, most of us reading it would not have the experience. So we're being introduced to something that we didn't know about.
Right.
I think that makes the book interesting. Plus, you know something about Finns.
Yes, I do.
And that comes through, your sort of familiarity with their qualities. That was really interesting.
And of course, I don't know if you picked up on it, but Arnie, who is, Louise's husband, is the same little Arnie that was in Deep River. He was the son of Kilikki and Matti.
Right. I forgot that he's a continuous, a continuity character.
That's sort of what my wife called, she was in the software business. She calls those Easter eggs, people that know, I see that. So right. I dropped an Easter egg.
Right. And I think, isn't Ainu mentioned in this new book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, he says, well, my aunt, was here and that's the connection with, now her name went right out of my head. This is terrible. One other of my characters, but the woman who runs the orphanage,
right?
She was connected to the woman that took Ainu on after she got out of the Russian prison.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So it is. Yeah, I think it's nice to have that connection, and there you kind of, you sort of keep the familial element going, which I thought was really nice. So what we don't want to do is talk too much about the story because people, you'd want listeners to find out for themselves. So we won't necessarily talk about denouement or anything like that. But, at the core of this is a challenge between Mikhail, the Russian, and Arnie, the American, who meet re-meet because they had fought with each other in World War II, and at a kind of embassy event they re-meet and have this kind of drinking I don't know what you call it, a party, they're like,
they both get drunk at an embassy party.
But out of that comes this challenge, which one of them is the better skier, where they get to, they're proving their manhoods, and also in their minds, representing their countries, they still feel that way. America is better.
They're Russia both career, better. They're career military officers, and I've been around those people. And if there's anything about inter-service rivalry or rivalry with others, even if you're not at war, it's just part of the DNA. It's like, it's like African Americans when they do the dozens on each other. It's sort of like it's pretty damn good, satire and wicked jokes, but nobody gets mad about it. It's just sort of part of the deal. And that's what they were doing. They were taking each other on about, our ski troops were better than your ski troops. And at the same time, they both know the other guy's just doing a sort of a challenge, but it's a challenge. And you cannot, your honor does not allow you to not accept a challenge. And that's where they were. And they didn't think, that story is they think they can do it in secret, but that's where their naivete comes in.
Right. And of course, they engineer it to be done in secret. They, go to great lengths to find this, really far off part of Finland where they can do this several day race. Because so much of, there's some technical stuff about skiing. Is this stuff you knew about cross-country skiing, or did you have to research to find out what it was like?
I have two advantages. I have done cross-country skiing myself and in the Cascades here, pretty high mountain skiing. no trails, just, you know, in the woods. But I also have a good friend who I give credit to in the book, who's a Finnish Marine ski trooper. And he has another friend who's also a Marine. And I met them because of Matterhorn. They're active right now. I mean, these two guys are patrolling the Finnish border in this terrible winter conditions. And so they knew a lot about cross-country skiing under these kinds of severe conditions. And I would just email them with questions like, well, if he dug a hole, then how would he get his clothes dry? Okay, then they'd write back, well, this is the way you do it, you know? And so I had the combination of I've done it myself, but really the really good technical juicy stuff was from these two Finnish Marines.
Well, that's really cool. Do they also tell you about the topography? Because there's a lot of detail in there about going cross country there that I think you wouldn't necessarily know unless you had done some work or been there.
Yeah, no, one of them actually did it on a map, figured out how many kilometers you could do in a day, how much food you need, which river valleys you'd go down, which lakes you'd go on. I mean, no, that whole thing is absolutely authentic. I mean, it's right down to the absolute detail. And I wanted to have a map, but the publisher says it's too expensive. So
no, I think actually a map would have been good. Sorry that your publisher disagreed, you know, maybe on the end papers or something, because it would be, I think it would be really, I mean, it is a novel, you know, it's not, we use our imaginations. It's not like nonfiction, but there are elements there that, you know, kind of would be, it's sort of like the maps in a science fiction, not in a fantasy novel.
Or a Tolkien sort of universe. Yeah. I mean, I was trying to sort of create a world, which is what I try to do with all my novels. And, I have no doubt about that ski race. I don't think anybody can, you know, an author's nightmare is getting something wrong and then the internet hits you, you know, Amazon reviews. And on Matterhorn, I got the trigger mechanism on a Claymore mine wrong. And I can't tell you, I mean, you know, people, he's never been in Vietnam. He doesn't know what the trigger mechanism on an M79. And I mean, it was just like, oh my God, you know, so I'm terrified.
Well, no, I can understand that. I mean, because people love to catch you up.
Oh, yes.
You know, then you have to write a little discourse at the beginning of the book saying, you know, this is not real. I made it all up, but.
Right. Yeah. Well, as Hollywood people always say, I love it. You know, I was talking to one producer. I said, God, that movie was just so inauthentic. I think it was Pearl Harbor. And he says, Carl, we weren't making a documentary.
Right. No, and I, you know, you hear that from, you know, especially war movies from people who were there.
Yeah.
Will tell you, no, it wasn't like that at all. You know, one of the guys I knew growing up had been, I mean, you mentioned your father in Normandy. This guy was, he was a ensign in the Navy. He ran one of the first landing ships, LSTs, onto the beach in Normandy. So he was there. He knew what it was like. And he was very kind and generous when he saw like D-Day and movies like that. It's just like, it's okay. That's a movie. There's no way you can show anybody what it was really like to be under fire. And I think that's probably true. I mean, I think it's better writing because there you allow us to imagine, you know, that's the advantage that writing has over anything visual, any film, that I can visualize for myself what you're writing about.
Yeah. My take on like movies versus literature is that you can only see the story through the eye of a camera. Exactly. Whereas with literature, you can actually identify with a character and see the world through someone else's eyes. And that can affect actual change in your psyche because you, in a way, have experienced it as opposed to watching it. There's a very big difference.
Yeah.
And I think that's the advantage literature has. And of course, movies have their own advantage. You don't have to put too much effort into them. You know?
Well, it's true, but they can only, as you're right about that. I think that's another way of saying what I think about it is that there's a limitation in the video or in the visual that the novel gives you more space for the imagination. And you're right, the identification and the ability to sympathize or empathize with the character and understand the character is greater. Not always. I mean, because there are scenes in film where, you know, they get it pretty powerfully. But
yeah, but I still don't think you see it through those characters' eyes.
Right, because the camera's always, yeah, you're always looking at them and not through them.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the going back to the ski race, I thought your descriptions of what it was like for Artie were pretty powerful. You know, and of course, there are other scenes with Mikhail that were pretty powerful too, which we will leave for the readers to find out itself. But I, you know, I also thought you did a great job of writing the female characters and making them believable and sympathetic in each in their own ways. You know, you have the American Louise and the Russian Natalia, who are, you know, become friends, but who can never actually become as close as they want to be.
Right.
And it's, you know, that's also very, it's a very, there's a deep sadness in their relationship.
How a human relationship, which would have been so natural, is completely blocked by politics.
Right.
You know, and it's the way we are. I mean, like just right now, I mean, you know, I have friends who believe the election was stolen, and I've known them for 40 years, and it's hard not to just get angry with them and say, screw you, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I mean, I'm pretty cool about it, but I just roll my eyes and say, well, you're just wrong, you know, but, and they're okay with me that way too, but it's dicey. And I know a lot of people who just simply won't make friends with somebody if they're on the wrong political side. Okay. You know, I mean, so it's not just Russians and Americans. It's, I don't know, we call them Trumplicans and Democrats, you know.
Well, I think, you know, I think we're in a bad place culturally and politically in that way because, you know, when I remember being, you know, a young hippie in the 60s, and there were a lot of people that I met who thought that I was ridiculous. And they hated me and they didn't like my values. Mm-hmm. And we became really good friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an element where, you know, I was able to talk to people that were way different from me. And we could have, you know, we could become close. I think it's much harder now. I think that there is a, I think it has to do with, you know, with the media, and it has to do with the internet, isolation of people and the destruction of communities and the small towns that
absolutely. I mean, one of the things that, again, an underlying theme of Cold Victory is, you have one character who has no privacy. The only thing that she can do is talk to her husband if they're in bed whispering. There's always just problems of somebody telling the truth or not. I mean, you know, it's like, I don't know if, even if my husband comes home from work and he says what happened that day, whether he's actually telling me the truth or not, because he may not be able to say it because the au pair that's living with us is reporting to the, you know, equivalent of the KGB. But what's, to me, a danger is, and I hope that readers pick up on it, is that we don't need a totalitarian government to do that. We're doing it to ourselves. We're doing it to ourselves. We are getting rid of privacy. You know, we got these things running around. Hey, Siri. Well, they're listening in, you know, and your cell phone is with you all the time. Me, you know, and on television now, what is, I don't know, is this true or is this false? I mean, I still have sources that I think, well, you know, public television is still, I think, honorable. They're not really going to say, but it's getting to the point where you start to wonder. And so, but that isn't because of a totalitarian government. That's because we're doing it to ourselves.
Yeah.
And I'm a little frightened of that.
Well, I think with good reason. I think there is we're in danger. And it's not going to be solved readily because that you can't the ability to over, you know, to alter those impediments, let's say, to interaction, human interaction, and, you know, believing in the same reality I mean, that is right. It's really important to a culture to have a cohesive belief system that we don't have to all have the same opinions or ideas, but we do have to agree on the basis of reality. Yeah. And without that, it's really hard to have a culture, and a culture makes a country. So
we're in danger. Yeah. There is no such thing as alternate facts, but they exist.
Oh, I agree. Well, Carl, it's been great to talk to you, both about the book and about other things. So
I appreciate this. Yeah.
And I hope that this book does really well. And
thank you.
I'm looking forward to your next book.
Okay.
So this has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Welk. I've been talking to Carl Orlantes about Cold Victory.